Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we'd be glad to talk to you about those. And if you have a difference of opinion from the host, we'd be glad to talk to you about that too. We've got an open forum here about the Bible and Christianity, and you can participate in any appropriate way you wish if you use this number. The number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And we'd be glad to talk to you anytime in this half hour. Of course, if you call early, you have a much better chance of making it in before the half hour ends. Let's talk to Sandy, first of all, from San Jose. Sandy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm calling today on totally something different than I've ever called on. It's about a personal situation with a friend of mine who, in my mind, has flipped out. He's Jewish. He became a Christian, and now he's involved in the Hebraic Roots movement. I think it's a cult-like, I think. They believe that the New Testament has been corrupted. They believe in this holy name, always speaking Yeshua. He's done some real wacky things. Can you shed some light on this movement, what your understanding is of it?
Yeah, well, you know, nobody has the right to label a cult, or everybody does, because the Bible doesn't use the word cult, and because of that, people use the word however they wish. You know, some people reserve the word for groups that don't believe that Jesus is God or don't believe the Trinity. In that respect, I'm not sure where the Hebrew Roots movement stands, because that's not usually what I've heard them talk about.
Let me ask this, Steve. Forget the word cult. Let's pull that word out of it. This guy did some really bizarre things. So let's say, is this a good movement within Christendom, or is it on the fringe?
No, it's not a good movement, in my opinion.
Okay.
And it is a cult, in my opinion. But like I said, my definition of cult is not authoritative. Everybody uses their own definition of cult.
I understand.
But as I was saying, they may be orthodox with reference to principal doctrines like the Trinity. I don't know. But they definitely undermine the historic Christian faith, which has always recognized Paul as an apostle. And basically, you see, here's the deal. Either Paul is an apostle or he's a false apostle, because he claimed to be an apostle. So he either has to be a real one or a false one. If you don't claim to be an apostle, you don't stand the chance of being a false apostle. But if you do claim to be an apostle, you're either a real one or a false one. Now, Paul claimed in every letter to be an apostle of Jesus Christ. He also claimed that he had met Christ on the road to Damascus in a supernatural encounter where Christ actually gave him that position of apostle to the Gentiles. Now, either Paul's a complete liar and should be exposed, or else he's an apostle of Jesus Christ. Now, if he's an apostle of Jesus Christ, like Jesus said in John 13:20, he that receives him that I send, that's an apostle.
Right.
An apostle is the sent one. He that receives the one that I send receives me. And that's obvious. You know, if someone sends you an official messenger and you reject that messenger, then you reject the person who sent him. So if Paul's story is true, then Paul's letters have to be taken as authoritative. That would include Paul's letter to the Galatians, his letter to the Colossians, his letter to the Ephesians, all of which, even Romans, which I think all of them are death to Jewish legalism. Now, the interesting thing here is that Peter apparently accepted Paul as an apostle. In 2 Peter chapter 3, although Peter doesn't mention Paul's apostleship, he mentions all of Paul's letters. Now, and speaks of being familiar with the contents of Paul's letters. Well, anyone who's read Paul's letters knows that he claims to be an apostle in those letters. So Peter, if he felt that Paul was not an apostle, he had better warn the church against this dangerous character who's claiming to be an apostle. Instead, in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 15 and 16, Peter refers to Paul as our beloved brother, Paul, and says that Paul's letters say the same things that Peter's letters say. And you can see that. I mean, if you read 1 Peter, it's almost a repeat of Ephesians from Paul. You know, there's really a great agreement between Paul and the other apostles. Now, the Hebrew Roots movement doesn't like Paul because they are Judaizers. And Paul was locked into conflict with Judaizers from the beginning. He was the public enemy number one of Judaizers after he became a Christian. Now, before he became a Christian, he was a public enemy number one of Christians. And then when he became a Christian, he became public enemy number one of the Judaizers, and they hated him. And that's why the Jerusalem Council was held, to see if Paul was right or if the Judaizers were right. And the council, which was made up of all the apostles and elders of Jerusalem, stood with Paul, not with the Judaizers. So any movement that's trying to impose Jewish practices, especially on Gentile Christians, but even on Jewish Christians, I think is the same error that you find in the Galatians epistle. But they don't care because they just discount Paul.
So real quickly, I know this is a short show. What's the main problems with this faith or this cult?
You named some of them. They believe that everything Hebrew has to be reintroduced, including the festivals, including, some of them I've talked to actually say we should have animal sacrifices again, but we can't because we don't have the temple yet. But, I've had them call me and tell me that they believe that we should have animal sacrifices again. In other words, they are under the old covenant, which Paul said to the Galatians, if you're circumcised and you're obligated to keep the whole law and you've fallen from grace, you've defected from Christ.
And what do they believe of Jesus then?
They believe he was the Messiah, but they believe he came to establish Mosaic customs. Not that he had to. I don't know why he'd have to do that. John the Baptist could have done that without the Messiah coming, or any prophet. All the prophets did that in the Old Testament. But they believe Jesus just came to establish the law and the Torah for all people. And but it's funny because it's almost humorous the way they feel like you have to call him Yeshua. You have to use Hebrew names for people and stuff like that. It just shows a fascination for all things Jewish. And I know that you're Jewish, and it's interesting. And it's good that you're not caught up with that kind of thing, because a lot of Jewish Christians, but even I think maybe even more Gentile Christians get caught up with this. And I think it may be sort of a guilt trip that Gentiles feel. You know, Gentiles have persecuted the Jews in the past. We want to really give them their due now. And all things Jewish, some Christians are just enamored with all things Jewish. And it's a shame because we're supposed to be enamored with all things Jesus.
And they're also dispensational, I think, because he thinks, he left the United States because he thinks we're under judgment as a nation. He's gone to the Caribbean for some reason thinking that's out of God's reach. It's blown my mind.
I don't know that he's wrong about that. I'm not sure he's wrong about that. But I don't think the Caribbean's out of God's reach, but I don't know but that America might not be under God's judgment. I'm not a prophet, so I can't say.
But
it could be true.
Right.
But
okay,
that's not the issue.
Yep. Sorry?
I said his thoughts about America would not be the issue. His thoughts about Christianity would be the issue. Just trying to impose Jewish legalism is what Paul was adamantly opposed to and wrote several epistles to condemn.
Okay. Well, go ahead. I'll take your next call. I know it's a short show. This has been a real weird thing for me this weekend. So thanks so much, Steve, for all the work you do.
Well, thanks. Before you go, Sandy, let me just say, why don't you ask him what he thinks about Paul's conversion story and his claim to be an apostle. I mean, maybe he's already told you what he thinks, but if he denies that Paul's an apostle, I would ask him why. Now, he'll probably say because he spoke contrary to what Jesus said. I'm dealing with a guy on our Bible forum. Have you been on our Bible forum on our website?
No, I have not. I'm not a great typer, so I'm a
Well, author. You don't have to type. You can just read. But there's a lot of guys there, but there's a Hebrew Roots type guy on there basically saying that Paul was a false prophet because he didn't teach the same things that Jesus did. I made a list for him of the things that Jesus and Paul both taught, which is all the essentials of Jesus' teaching Paul taught also. And, in fact, Paul even said that anyone who doesn't follow the words of our Lord Jesus Christ knows nothing and is not a Christian. So, I mean, Paul and Jesus taught the same things. If someone says they didn't, they either are misunderstanding Jesus or Paul or both, probably both.
Wow, I've been taken aback on this whole thing. It's blown me away. He's ripped me out of money. I mean, a bunch of other weird things have happened. I mean, I could consider him a brother. Anyway. Well, Steve, thank you so much. I'll go into your forum so I can look more stuff up, and I really appreciate your counsel and support.
All right. Hey, Sandy, if you send me your email address, address, I can send you a link to where I'm discussing this on the forum.
Oh, that'd be great. You haven't changed email addresses, right? It's the same one. It's on your website, I guess, right?
Mine's the same. Yeah, mine's the same.
Okay. I'll get you an email off
from
this
the
one.
Website.
Thanks so much.
All right. God bless you, Sandy. Good talking to you. Let's talk to David from Temecula. David, welcome.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Great. Good to hear from you.
Good talking to you. Hey, quick question on, and I understand on Levitical law that they did a sacrifice for people to, I don't know if you'd call it being saved or not, and then after Christ we were saved through him. What was the process between Adam and Moses, or maybe even Adam and Abraham? How did people come to God and be saved or be forgiven?
Well, we have record of some people who did, right? I mean, Enoch walked with God before the flood, and Noah, of course, and Abraham and his kin were before Moses. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, all these guys were before the law of Moses was given.
Right.
So what do we find? You know, the answer, I think, is given in Genesis 15:6, where it says that Abraham, who, of course, was one of the people living during that time, says Abraham believed in the Lord, and it was counted to him for righteousness. If God counts you as righteous, I think you're saved. And so it was through faith. And when you look at Hebrews chapter 11, and it goes through that's the faith chapter, it talks about by faith, Abel offered a better sacrifice. By faith, Enoch walked with God. By faith, Noah built an ark. By faith, Abraham left his country. By faith, he offered Isaac, and so forth. It's pointing out that people before the time of Moses were saved by faith. But then it points out that even Moses and people after that were saved by faith. As you go through Hebrews 11, you find that it starts out with Abel way back in Genesis 4 and goes through all the prophets and through the entire Old Testament. And it picks out the main characters and says this person was saved by faith too, and this person by faith, and by faith, and by faith. So basically the teaching of Scripture is that everybody has always been saved by faith or not at all. It's true that a person who has faith in God it's part of believing in God that you are committed to obeying him. And so obeying God was differently described at different times. I mean, Cain and Abel were told to offer animal sacrifices and of a certain sort, and Abel obeyed and offered the right kind, and Cain the wrong kind. Now, no one got saved by offering sacrifices, because it says in Hebrews chapter 9 that it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. That was just a system of types and shadows. God commanded them to do it for a purpose, but it wasn't for the purpose of saving them. It was for the purpose of testifying to the coming sacrifice of Christ ultimately. But the point is that people who believe God obey God. And therefore, when the law was given, faithful people obeyed the law. Before the law was given, faithful people obeyed whatever else God wanted them to do. But it was never their obedience per se that saved them. It was their obedience that rose out of faith. It wasn't the thing they were doing. It was who they were obeying and why that saved them.
Okay, great. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Good question, Dave. God bless you.
All right, you have a great day. Love you.
Okay, you too. Bye now. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Our next caller is Lou from Los Angeles, and we have a line open for you also if you're interested in calling. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Lou from Los Angeles, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you a question I'm confused about. Ecclesiastics from verses 19 to 21, basically it says that whatever happens to the sons of men also happens to animals, and it says man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, all return to the dust. Then it says who knows if the spirits of the son of men goes upward or the spirit of the animal goes down to the earth. And then my Bible has a reference 12:7 where it says the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. My question is, the spirit that returns to God who gave it, is that the spirit of the animal also? And what happens if to the spirit of the animal? I never knew that a spirit could be buried like a body.
Well, first of all, the fact that Ecclesiastes says that men and animals die and have exactly the same fate as each other is not necessarily going to be suitable for doctrine, for the simple reason that the Bible teaches other things elsewhere, that man and animals are not constituted the same. Now, some things may be the same, and that's one thing Solomon notes there, is that people die and animals die. That's that we have in common with them. What happens after death, Solomon is not too sure about. He says, who's to say whether the spirit of the man goes upward and the spirit of the animal goes downward? He's actually speculating. I said, who knows about that? One thing we know is they all die. And really, in the Old Testament, there isn't a teaching really anywhere that specifies what happens to people after they die, much less after animals die. You know, the New Testament does talk about eternal life. The New Testament does talk about eternal destinies for people. But it too is silent on the you know, post-mortem condition of animals. The Bible just doesn't talk about that subject. And people speculate about it. Some people think that some of the higher animals do have a soul. I mean, let's face it, dogs seem to have personality. Actually, even lots of animals seem to have personality. Is personality the same thing as soul? I mean, they're individualist creatures. Is that just something that's, you know, built into them in their physical brain, or is there something more to an animal? I don't know the answer to that. My suspicion is that animals don't have what we have in terms of, continuing existence beyond death. But the Bible is not clear on what happens to animals after they die or what their situation is.
But what does it mean when it says, and the spirit will return to God who gave it? Is that referring to the human and the animal, or just the human? It doesn't specify. And then in Hebrew,
in chapter 12, I believe it's talking about humans there dying. I don't think chapter 12 is talking about animals dying, but he does liken the death of humans to the death of animals in chapter 3. But in chapter 12, I think he's mainly talking about human fates. He starts out by telling human beings, young men, to, you know, not waste their opportunities in this world to serve God. And he ends up that way, too. So I don't think he's talking about animal fates at the end. But even if he were, the word spirit in the Hebrew can also be translated breath. And sometimes that word is translated breath. The Hebrew word is ruach. And it can be translated wind or breath or spirit. And some would say that what Solomon was saying is that the body goes into the ground to the dust, but and the breath goes back to God who gave it. They're saying God is the one who gives breath, and God's the one who takes it away, that is, at death. So that there's a possibility that the statement is not even being made about post-mortem fates, just that when the body dies, the breath is taken from it. And figuratively speaking, God takes the breath back as he gave it. He recalls it. Now, I do believe that we have a spirit that lives on after death. That's my belief. And I think the Bible, on balance, teaches that in the New Testament. But I don't know that Solomon is teaching anything specific about the post-mortem awareness or destinies. I think he's speculating about what the meaning of life is. And he sees the fact that all men die, just like animals die, to be one of the factors that makes him think everything is vain and that everything is purposeless. Anyway, I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Richard from Ontario next. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Okay. I sure can.
Well, I was a little bit confused here in regards to John the Baptist. When he baptized Jesus and the heavens opened up and the voice of God came down and says that this is my beloved Son and the Holy Spirit comes upon Jesus, that yet later, mm-hmm. after he was imprisoned, he sends his disciple to ask Jesus if he is the one, the Messiah or the Christ. Where did this doubt come from when he heard the voice himself?
Where did the doubts come from? The doubts come from the human heart. In the Bible and in real life, we find this all the time. God will do something amazing something that you'd say, well, I'll never doubt God again because some stupendous answer to prayer or something happens, or, you know, he'll part the Red Sea and the Israelites will pass through and they'll say, wow, you know, God is great. We'll never doubt him again. But then within 3 days, they're wondering, you know, if God's so good after all, because they're thirsty. People do waver. Consistency is not a human trait, I'm afraid. It should be, but it isn't. And, you know, John the Baptist had revelations from God, including that one, that God said, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased. But when he was in prison some, you know, time later and rotting there, and Jesus was not doing what he thought the Messiah was supposed to do, I think doubts came into his mind. We might think, oh, a great man of God like him, he can't have doubts. Oh, great men of God have always been attacked by the devil with doubts. I mean,
right.
Now, there are different ways that people have understood John's question to Jesus. When John sent messengers to Jesus, he said, are you the one who is to come, or do we look for another? It may be that John knew and didn't have serious doubts, but that he was trying to spur Jesus on to do the thing that, you know, that he thought the Messiah was supposed to be doing. After all, John and most Jews believed that the Messiah would overthrow the Romans. And John was sitting in a third world jail, incarcerated by the Romans. So he'd be real happy if Jesus would get on with the program, get the Romans out, and get John out of jail. And it looked like Jesus wasn't doing anything at all in that direction. And so he could have just been trying to spur Jesus on, say, come on, you know, are you going to get with the program or not? Or is someone else coming to do it? Now, there's also some have... Go ahead.
No, I was just listening. Okay, then again.
Some also have the theory. I'm sorry, when you speak, it makes me think your sentence up. I'm sorry. Let me put you on hold so I don't get confused here. Also, many people think that John sent the disciples to ask Jesus that because John's disciples wondered. Not that John had doubts, but that his disciples had doubts about Jesus. And so he said, well, go ask them. You know, if they're saying to John, hey, how come Jesus isn't doing the Messiah thing? How come he's not springing you from jail? John may not have had doubts, but his disciples did, and John might have said, well, go ask him yourself and see what he says, knowing that Jesus would give them an answer that would satisfy them. So there's different theories about this, but on the surface, it looks like John did have doubts, and that's not impossible. Even though John had seen great things, I have to say, there are many people listening to me right now who were part of the Jesus movement in the 70s, and they were on fire for God. They saw prayers answered. They saw what they regarded to be miracles. They never thought they'd ever doubt God again. And some of them have backed away from God since then. Why? Because people are inconsistent. It's a shame. God isn't, but people are. And even John, I believe, was. And that was, you know, just a human trait.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well.
All right, Richard, I appreciate your call there. I'm sorry. I think we may have a little delay so that we're kind of, it's kind of disjointed there. Let's talk to Andrew from San Diego. Andrew, welcome.
How you doing, Steve? Thanks for taking my call. I had a quick question. In ancient times, I understand there's a form of writing that was used. This is what someone told me, a form of writing that was used to explain the Bible and all types of writings in story form. The person that was mentioning to me this is saying that the Bible is all metaphor of its actual factual, he just believes that it's just all a story. So I'm trying to understand what's this style of writing that he's mentioning, and how is it that people use this type of method to write things that have some type of meaning to it.
Did your friend use the word midrash?
He never gave me a name. He couldn't remember the name for it.
Okay. Well, the Jewish rabbis taught in what is called Midrash form, where they did come up with non-literal meanings to biblical stories and gave them, you know, spiritual lessons that were based on not the actual factual information in the story. And some people think that the Gospels were written as Midrash too. These are people who want to basically suggest that the Gospels are not historically accurate. Most scholars do not agree with that. Or at least, let's just put it this way, scholars of equal credibility deny that. And I certainly don't think that's correct. I mean, there certainly is such thing as Midrash in the Talmud and so forth, but I don't think there's sufficient reason to believe that any of the stories in the Bible are examples of Midrash. There are parables in the Bible, and even on one occasion, there's a fable about trees talking, but it's not presented as a historical truth. When Jesus tells parables, he's not saying they're historically true. He's giving them as fictional stories to illustrate spiritual truths. Likewise, the trees talking and so forth is part of a sermon that someone's teaching, and he's deliberately giving it as a symbolic fable, just like Aesop's fables or something. There's different styles of writing in the Bible, and they do have to be understood in different ways. Some biblical writing is straightforward historical writing. In fact, most of it, I think, is. But in the prophets, a lot of the writing is poetry. In fact, almost all of the prophets in the Old Testament write in poetry. Now, poetry uses figures of speech and symbols and things like that. It doesn't mean it's impossible to understand it. Even the English poets use figures of speech and such, but we don't usually have too much trouble figuring out what they're talking about. If we do, they weren't very good poets, you know. There's also what they call apocalyptic literature. There's not very many examples of that in the Bible, but the book of Revelation is one example of apocalyptic, and Daniel and Zechariah also are apocalyptic, and there's portions of other books that are. But apocalyptic literature is very sensationalistic symbolism, depicting normal realities in the imagery of almost mythology, with dragons, monsters, and, you know, angels fighting in heaven and things like that. Anyway, there are different styles, and you do definitely, when you read the Bible, have to recognize if you're reading a parable or apocalyptic or poetry, you don't interpret it quite the same as with prose, with historical narrative. I'm afraid I'm out of time, but certainly studying the Bible is a study. It is something that requires some mental activity, and you should study to show yourself approved unto God, Paul said. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.
Hello, good morning, and thanks for being here today to listen to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. This is a live interactive call-in program that's helping so many people along their spiritual journey, and we hope it helps you too. But the one way we can make sure that it helps as many people as possible is to keep Steve on the air. And if you'd like to be able to be a part of that, please go to his website. There's a place there that you can donate very safely and securely. It's at thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. And we just want to say thanks for supporting this ministry and keeping Steve's voice on the air here on KBRIGHT in Southern California. Please keep in mind that the views and opinions on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. Stay with us. Joyce Meyer is next on AM 740 KBRIGHT.
Long Beach, California. Get ready for a weekend full of excitement, powerful worship, and messages that will change your life. It's all part of the Joyce Meyer Ministries Conference Tour that's coming August 22nd through the 24th. Join thousands at the Giant Center. Be led in worship by contemporary Christian artist Bill Wickham. And hear New York Times best-selling author and practical Bible teacher, Joyce Meyer.
I said, even while you're maturing and changing, you can enjoy your imperfect self. I said, you can enjoy your imperfect self.
The best part is, admission is free. Sessions begin Thursday night, August 22nd. Just call 1-866-C-JOYCE or check out joycemeyer.org for all the details.
KVRT at KVRT HD Costa Mesa and on the web at KVRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Change. Do you feel stuck where you are right now? Maybe you desire a new job or want to find a fresh start somewhere new. Or are you looking for something more?
you want to go deeper with God and change who you are, but are unsure how. God can provide many ways to change that is more than just a new job. And in today's teaching, Joyce will share how you can gain the courage to choose change and be that much closer to Him. But before we start, I want to let you know that Joyce has a new book coming soon. The new title, God Is Not Mad at You, will be released September 3rd. You can pick it up wherever books are sold. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, Change.
Something needs to change. And you know what? We say that a lot when we're unhappy with things the way they are. Something needs to change. But sadly, we say that and then do nothing. Something needs to change. We say that when we realize that we're just working too hard. We say that when we get the revelation we're just too busy. That our schedule is too full. That we've made too many commitments. Well, I've just got too many commitments. Something needs to change. Well, I'm just too busy and too stressed out. Something needs to change. These kids are just out of control. Something needs to change. Come on. But what exactly is it that we think is going to happen then? What's going to happen is you're going